Welcome back to the third and final special conference edition of Dive and Dig, a podcast brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that promotes maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. In the first two episodes, we explored a range of maritime archaeological sites being studied by archaeologists from around the world. However, regrettably, something that many of them have in common is the risk of being damaged or destroyed. So in this episode, Protecting Our Past, we hear from four speakers about innovative ways that they are protecting sites whilst also raising awareness about our maritime cultural heritage. Here's Kathy and Lauren at the conference to tell us more.
I'm here with Maya now, and yesterday we were in a session looking at the lessons from the history of maritime archaeology, and a talk that came up that was really interesting was the lessons that are being learnt in Croatia in terms of protecting our underwater heritage. So could you just firstly introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Maya Kaleb. I'm an archaeologist in Education and Documentation Department of International Centre for Underwater Archaeology in Zadar, which is Category 2 Centre UNESCO's.
Yeah, we were in Croatia last year actually for another conference, and Zadar is absolutely beautiful. But what we were looking at yesterday was a technique that we saw that was being used to put cages over particular archaeological sites to protect them. Could you just tell us a bit more about the protection techniques that you've been using?
Yeah, that was the idea from the 90s when we were trying to find a way to protect sites in situ from the looters. Metal cages were introduced in 1997. In Croatia, and since then, eight cages have been put on in situ sites. And this method of protection has its advantages and disadvantages, of course. And bearing in mind the level of endangerment of individual sites with regard to their location, so it's not always simple to control the area where the cages are. And of course, the problem of cage maintenance for their use for touristical purposes. We have a bad example of how the idea was actually to have this physical and mental protection, because the idea is that if you go into a cage, it's like going into someone's house. So you know that you are doing something bad the moment you are entering the doors that exists actually, but they are meant for archaeologists and for researchers who need to go to the site itself.
Mm. Yeah, that's something that is really interesting and a real challenge, I think, for underwater archaeology, because it is a bit out of sight, out of mind sometimes.
Yes.
So people, I think, you know, you wouldn't go to a terrestrial archaeological site and start taking amphora.
Exactly.
Off of it. But underwater, there's this different mindset. So
yes.
What do you think?
People are very fascinated with underwater sites, you know, and we have this mentality. I don't know if it's Croatian a thing or a Mediterranean thing or world thing, that everyone wants to have souvenir. When they see something, they want to have a piece of history with themselves. And that is a problem, because one artifact in someone's house, it doesn't have any value if it's not presented to the wider public, if it's not if researchers don't do their thing and research about the object, and of course the context. Context mm-hmm. is very important, and if you take one object from the site, it's losing its story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So ultimately, what is the way forward in Croatia, but also more widely in maritime archaeology, to help with these sites?
We're doing a lot of exhibitions that we are trying to get close to the audience, to the people, and try to explain them why is heritage so important and why it's a heritage of all of us. Not only archaeologists, you know, we do the research, but it's for everyone. Yeah. And we try to do different forms of virtual presentations. But what we need to do is to change the public perception of heritage and to make it known and appreciated. Yeah. When you know something, it's familiar to you and you emotionally connect to that thing. Mm-hmm. So I think the local community is like nucleus, like the base for raising awareness of the sites, mm-hmm. and of the objects. If you tell someone that's in front of your yard, that's in your yard, and if someone else comes from the outside and take it, then you will lose part of your history also. And then people connect with the site. Of course, education. We do a lot of underwater archaeology courses, also mm-hmm. conservation courses in our center. Mm-hmm. And we attract a lot of people from all over the world. They are mostly archaeology students, but we also have NAS courses.
Oh, great.
We are official partner of Nautical Archaeology Society. So we are trying to have as much non-archaeologists to our courses so we can raise awareness of heritage in general.
That's really important. Oh, yeah. That's so fascinating. Well, thank you very much for your time.
You're
really
welcome.
Appreciate it, and enjoy the conference.
Thank you. It was my honor.
So I'm just having a sit down with Qatar right now, who spoke yesterday on a really interesting subject to do with photogrammetry, which is a tool that's not only used to record sites, but he's actually been using it now to monitor sites and help with their protection and management. So if you could just introduce yourself for us.
My name is Kotaro Yamafune. I went to Texas A&M University to get master's and PhD. Originally, I was doing history of shipbuilding, especially 16th century Portuguese ship, because they were the first European came to Japan. But when I was doing some excavation project, I realized that recording by hand are not so accurate. That's why I started using photogrammetry to get data for myself, for my research. But now, many people ask me to use photogrammetry, so I've been in many different countries helping different projects, then realized photogrammetry can be used for monitoring and also the tools to fight against treasure hunters.
Mm, yeah, that was something I found really interesting, because over the last few years, really sort of 5 years or so, we're seeing increasing numbers of 3D models that have been created of sites using photogrammetry,
yes.
making site plans so much quicker than you say, than doing drawing using offsets by hand and mm-hmm. the inaccuracies of trying to use a tape measure underwater. So that's great. But yeah, as you say, to then use it as a monitoring tool to look at how a site has changed and potentially been damaged by looters, that mm-hmm. is quite a new thing that I haven't seen used very much. So could you just explain, like, how do you go about understanding the change?
Okay, first you have to have scale constraint georeference 3D models, not only 1 year, but like, you know, from different times, so this year and next year. Then as far as this has millimeter accuracy in size and georeferencing, then it's not 3D models. You can think this as duplication or digital copy of archaeological site. In that case, you have 3D model from this year and next year, and you can overlap each other. Then in different software, I'm using Cloud Compare, which is a free amazing software. Then you can visualize and you can quantify changes happening on archaeological site. If you have some like Roman site, which has a lot of amphorae. Then, many cases, we don't know which amphora is possibly looted or intact. In that case, using GIS tools, you can find out which amphora is actually missing. Then, the important thing is that photogrammetry is basically composed of hundreds and thousands of high-resolution photos. So you can extract, you can create a markers on 3D model, which is missing object. Then you can extract the photos, high resolution photos. So the point is you can have a photo catalog of missing object. And this is photogrammetry. So you have all dimension of diameter of lead and handles. Then you have a catalog of missing object, the complete the catalogs, then you can have the catalog to track down treasure hunters or missing object. So far, treasure hunters were saying, oh no, this is not from like a stolen object. This is from my grandparents' treasure or something, like they lied. But now we have catalogs, dimensions, and high-resolution photos to point out, no, this is not from your grandfather's place. This is the stolen artifact from this site, and this site is registered as important cultural property.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to return the artifact to the museum. So we can use photogrammetry in that way.
That's fascinating. And how about other sites? So not just shipwrecks. For example, mm-hmm. if you were looking at a submerged landscape or harbour site, I know you mentioned yesterday about monitoring how much sand had been recovered during excavation, but could you use it to look at how the site and the seabed has changed due to things like natural processes, storminess perhaps? Over a course of a few years, you could see how a site could be being damaged, for example, by underwater erosion or sediment movement. Do you think you could do that?
Absolutely. You need a bigger area, but you can track sediment and erosions and every changes.
Mm-hmm.
If you do periodically, you can kind of track changes, all changes has happened on the site. But in that case, you can kind of project into future, right? So you can kind of predict what's gonna happen next year or in 10 years. So you can compose a wiser management plan.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and more people are realizing now that photogrammetry, yeah, that's great to create your site plan, but it's got so many other uses in terms of the monitoring, the management, the protection of sites that can be used across. And it's, you know, it's a relatively easy thing to do.
And cheap things to do.
Yeah, and especially with some of the software you mentioned. And you're doing training as well, aren't you? And doing workshops so that other people can learn the techniques that you're doing. So
yes.
That's great. Thank you. Is there a way we can learn more about the work you do? Do you have a website or anything?
No, but you can ask me to provide the workshop.
Okay.
I mean, many people ask me to host workshop in their countries. In that case, you can teach, you can share knowledge of photogrammetry, how to use it with your colleagues and students.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
So we've just been in a session about underwater parks and blue growth, which was actually really interesting. And I'm here now with Päivi to talk about Baltic dive parks. So could you just introduce yourself?
Yes. So my name is Päivi Pihlanjärvi and I work at the Finnish Heritage Agency. I'm a maritime archaeologist.
Excellent. And the talk that you just gave was about the dive parks. I think there was, is it six parks that you've got now that you were discussing? And these are essentially underwater sites that people can dive on, get information on, and find out more about our underwater heritage. Could you just tell us a bit more about the dive parks, how long they've been going, and your involvement?
Yes, so we actually, in Finland, we established the first dive park in the Baltic Sea. It was in year 2000, and it's a Helsinki underwater park of Kronprins Gustav Adolf, and which was a Swedish ship of the line that sank in the late 18th century. And of course, then we have some other parks that have been established during an EU project called Palttasaar a few years ago. They are situated in southern Finland as well, in Hanko and Kemiönsaari. We have a lot of volunteers who want to participate as well. So there has been a Finnish Maritime Archaeological Society who has a wreck park in Porkkala. And then also other diving clubs that are interested in doing that.
That's brilliant, because I think, you know, the tricky thing that we hear a lot is that underwater sites aren't very accessible, or they're out of sight, out of mind, and that means that people aren't so much aware of our underwater heritage, and therefore the protection of it is behind really what's being protected on land. So are you finding that these dive parks are helping with ultimately with the management and protection of heritage?
Definitely. There are many reasons for that, especially the mooring buoys that we boot every spring for the boats, so that the boats wouldn't anchor. So anchoring is a really big problem because you can hurt the wrecks so much by doing that. Mm-hmm. So and of course, if it increases the use of underwater cultural heritage, we're happy. It's for everyone, and everyone should visit it. And during like establishment of the dive parks, we've always done some museum exhibitions as well, and we've delivered brochures and maps and 3D prints for people who don't dive.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. Yeah, not everyone is able to dive or wants to dive. So if you can bring the archaeology to the surface in that respect, in terms of virtual reality and exhibitions. And did you say one of yours was one of the most visited exhibitions in a particular period?
Yes, in Hankou Museum, they had an exhibition about the dive parks around Hankou and other wrecks as well around Hankou.
Oh, that's excellent. And so basically, I guess, so what happens? They go down and see some signage, introduces them to the site, and they follow like a line, I guess, around like a trail, I suppose. Is that
yes,
right?
It depends on a park, but like Helsinki Underwater Park is that like the classical example of a dive park where you just go down, you have the buoy, and you go down, and then you see the line and you start following the line, and then there are information signs. There are like 12 information signs all around the wreck, telling about the wreck and what you can see now and what's on your right side and left side. And there's also, because of course wrecks are biological reefs, there's also one sign about animals living there and plants.
Brilliant. Oh, that's nice. And you said there are guest books on the site that people can sign.
Yes.
I love that.
Yeah, people really like it a lot, so they can have their signature there.
Yeah, excellent. Oh, that's really interesting. Well, thank you very much. I would love to be able to dive on some of these dive parks, maybe one day. But yeah, we really appreciate your time. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, now we're taking a little leap and we're in Iceland, a place that you would think has amazing maritime archaeology, but in fact, over to you. Tell us more.
Yeah, hi, I'm Alex. I'm a British citizen, but living in Iceland and have lived in Iceland for 7 years now. And yeah, so I arrived and ended up really getting into maritime archaeology just out of interest and my own interest to dive and dive on interesting sites. But then through research, sort of found out that there isn't really much going on, and so yeah, I built my PhD project wanting to improve on it.
Right, and you said that you have whaling stations and medieval sort of trading areas. Is that how what sort of piqued your interest?
Yeah, so I ended up doing my master's thesis on coastal heritage management, and I specifically was looking at Norwegian 19th century whaling stations. So quite a lot of the whaling stations pre-20th century are all foreign, and Iceland only started whaling in the beginning of the 20th century.
Right, so then you decided to set up or call on the citizens of Iceland to help. Tell us more about what you did and how you went about it.
Yeah, so basically we have two maritime archaeologists in Iceland who are fully qualified to be able to excavate underwater sites. And that's obviously not enough to deal with all the sites that are around Iceland and that we know are there, but we haven't exactly located yet. And so my idea is that we can engage with the public and engage with the sports divers that we have in Iceland and train them to be able to provide monitoring for sites. So at the minute we're completely lacking any sort of baseline survey or condition of sites. And so the idea is that, yeah, the community can go out there and as they're doing their usual dives can also bring back information to the Heritage Agency on how the sites are doing, if there's any threats, if there's any anything that we should be worried about and that needs further excavation by archaeologists.
And you did a survey of, how did you go about that? I mean, did you do it through the dive clubs or...?
Yes, so actually Facebook is used a lot, social media in Iceland, and quite a lot of things are done on Facebook. So it actually made my survey quite easy to distribute. And so I distributed it within the Facebook groups for diving specifically. So we have a group that's Do You Want to Dive With Me? And you tell people where you're going and they can join. And we also have the Sports Divers Association. And everyone was really happy to distribute it within their own personal sort of Facebook groups of diving as well. And I was really just looking to collect information on how people see archaeological sites. Are they aware of any? What value they think they might have? And also if they'd want to be involved in a project that engages them and that asks them to survey.
Right, okay. Ultimately, you want the community to really take over, don't you? And make yourself almost redundant. You talked
exactly.
About that.
Exactly. Yeah. That is my complete aim, that I can take myself out of this and the community have the confidence and the skills to be able to carry on. So at some point, I'm going to be out of funding and finish my PhD, and I don't want that to be the end of the project. So I'm really, really pushing for sustainability.
Right, fantastic. And how long do you think it'll take before you reach that point?
So I have funding for 2 years, and that's the funding supplied by the Icelandic Research Centre. At that point, I'd like to hand in my PhD and have something written down. But in reality, 2 years is not a long time with a community engagement project. By then, I at least want to have the sort of basics, but it's going to take a lot of building and hopefully enthusiastic volunteers to continue the work after I've handed in a piece of paper.
Right.
Yeah.
And then talk a little bit about the fact that you haven't, Iceland hasn't ratified the UNESCO Convention.
Yeah, so they considered it in 2013, which is already a long time after the convention was produced. So it was basically, I think it was briefly considered, and that's because it could cause issues with fishing, and Iceland's main export is fish, and it was only overtaken by tourism in the past couple of years as the biggest economic boost for the country. And so having a site that might be identified as very important and having the grounds around it expanded to protect the site might impact the fishing. And so obviously there's a lot of worries about that. And there was also that there was some mention of a clash with the law of the sea. So I think quite a lot of European countries have also said the same thing, that there's some clash with UNCLOS, but I haven't actually found out exactly what that clash is.
So that's a challenge still to face, isn't it?
One of the many.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Fascinating.
Thank you.
I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Ultimately, it's about raising awareness. We can put a cage around a site, but the best form of protection is education and engaging people, involving local communities, sports divers, bringing visibility, as Myers told us. That regrettably brings us to the end of this special Dive and Dig conference podcast. Thanks to all our interviewees and to the ICOFA conference organisers, and a big thank you to you for listening. The next ICOFA conference will be held in Belgium in 4 years' time, but in November this year, the Honor Frost Foundation will be holding our own conference, Under the Mediterranean, hosted by the University of Malta. So join us then when we can bring you more exciting stories about our maritime past. Thanks for listening.